Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. John was just pointing out in the break that that everything we're talking about today comes out of the Fifth Circuit. So I was joking with him that that circuit is the one that's the most willing to give static to the administrative state. So that's probably why so much action is taking place there right now. But the next case that we're going to talk about out of the Fifth Circuit, and that, again, is the circuit that covers Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, is a unfortunate defeat for the New Civil Liberties Alliance. And Vec, I have to say, it would have been nice if the three judges in dissent, or the three judges, rather, who issued this decision in Cargill v. Garland, who were all dissenters in the case that we were just talking about in the Cochran v. SEC case, it would have been nice if they'd given us at least one day, one full day, to enjoy the victory in Cochran, rather than issuing this decision on December 14th, the day after the victory in Cochran. But
well,
it
rains on the just and the unjust, you know.
Well, precisely. And I don't pretend that this was a deliberate decision on the part of the judges. I assume these things come out of the clerk's office as they're ready and so forth. But they could have come out in reverse order or what have you. But as it happened, we learned about it one day later, which does not take the bloom off of the rose of the fantastic victory in Cochran. But we have more work to do in the Cargill case. So let me explain what is going on here. The judges are Dennis Higginson and Costa, and Higginson is the author of the unanimous opinion. And for those who've been following us, following our bump stock cases, before I forget to say it, this is case number 20-51016, if anyone wants to look this up and read the opinion in full. But anyone who's been following our bump stock cases knows that there is a pretty broad split in the circuits, or I should say rather among judges in the circuits, over this question of interpreting the statute that makes machine guns unlawful. And this one's unanimous, but we had the judges in the Tenth Circuit were split, I think, 6-5 on this question. The judges in the Sixth Circuit were split 8-8. The D.C. Circuit was split 2-1. And so the fact that that this is a unanimous decision may say more about the three judges who are on the panel than what the rest of the Fifth Circuit might think if it were to decide to hear this case en banc. But in any event, the judges in this decision focus all of their attention on the statutory question, and in fact, they even come around at the end of the opinion to suggest that essentially that Cargill could have been prosecuted under this statute even if the regulation had never been written, which I found that to be a pretty breathtaking statement, Vec, because I think that someone who owned a bump stock before this regulation came out would have been shocked to be prosecuted. And I think would not have been prosecutable. I think that any court with good sense, and certainly if it got up to the Supreme Court, they would have said, wait a minute, you can't sell somebody a bump stock that says in it that it's been approved for sale by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And then once they purchase it, arrest them for purchasing that as though it's unlawful. I mean, that's...
And not fraudulently. That agency authorized that to go in there. It's not like someone's
right.
Saying...
Yeah, exactly. So I found that... In fact, I guess I would say when I got to that part of the opinion, I thought, wow, I think they've maybe laid it on a little too thick here. That's it's an overdetermined opinion in that sense. But focusing just on the statutory interpretation piece of this, you may remember that 18 U.S.C. Section 921(a)(23) says that the term machine gun means any weapon which shoots, is designed to shoot, or can be readily restored to shoot automatically more than one shot without manual reloading by a single function of the trigger. So that's where all the action is on these multiple court of appeals cases now that that have been issued. And there are two terms in that definition of machine gun that are the focus of everyone's attention. One of them is the word automatically. What does that mean? And the second is the phrase single function of the trigger. And what does that mean? So the opinion dispenses pretty quickly with the notion that the Attorney General doesn't have authority to prescribe rules and regulations. And I want to pause on this, Vec, because I think that there's a piece here that hasn't really, I don't think any of the courts have really fully appreciated, which is when the Attorney General is given authority to prescribe rules and regulations necessary to enforce the National Firearms Act and the federal machine gun ban, the point of giving that authority is not so that they can enlarge the scope of the statute. That is not part of the authority given. So if and that's part of the objection here, is that this is a legislative rule. It makes something unlawful that wasn't unlawful before, and therefore it's enlarging the statute, and Congress did not give the Attorney General the power to do that. And moreover, I would point out, can't give that power to the Attorney General. I mean, under the non-delegation doctrine, you can't give criminal statute writing authority to the Attorney General. Now, the panel gets around that by saying that the statute always meant this, but not even the people who wrote this rule thought that the statute always meant this. They said that they think, sort of their considered judgment, this is a 1986 statute, by the way, so their considered judgment in 2018, some 32 years after the statute was written, is suddenly that this statute has a different meaning that it never had before. That's a problem maybe we can get into some other time. But I think there's a non-delegation problem in here as well. But the court sidestepped that and really just jumped into this statutory interpretation question. And what they say is that, and again, I would dispute this, but they say that the whole point of the law was to outlaw things that fire rapidly. But if that were true, and this came up in the district court, if that were true, Gatling guns would be illegal and would have been made illegal by the statute. But they're not. Gatling guns shoot very rapidly. There are all sorts of things that fire rapidly. That's not what the statute did. The statute makes a distinction between semi-automatic weapons, that is weapons that fire one bullet with each pull of the trigger, and automatic weapons, which once you've depressed the trigger and you don't release the trigger, the whole magazine empties. That's the distinction. That is the distinction in the statute. The regulation changes that distinction. And the regulation says that that the semi-automatic weapon is automatic too. Why does it say that? Well, according to the Fifth Circuit, the reason that's true is because they make no distinction between the additional effort that you have to put into firing a bump stock and firing a machine gun. They say that, well, with a machine gun, you have to depress the trigger, and then you have to keep the trigger depressed. So there's obviously additional, sort of work that you're doing there, and yet that's still automatic. Well, with a bump stock, to make it fire, not only do you have to keep your finger stationary on the trigger ledge rather than on the trigger itself, but on the trigger ledge, but then you have to push forward on the shroud of the barrel with your left hand, your non-trigger hand. You have to push forward on that while pulling back on the trigger ledge with your right hand simultaneously. You have to be pulling in opposite directions, and it's difficult because every time the gun fires, there's recoil, and so you have to overcome that recoil with the force of your hand on your non-trigger hand on the barrel shroud. That is a very difficult thing to do. And to analogize that to just simply holding down the trigger on a machine gun, or I think is well, I think it's specious, and I think that it's not really a fair reading of what Congress did here. Nonetheless, that is the tactic that the ATF took. It's the tactic that other courts that have reached the same conclusion about the meaning of the term have taken, and it's what the Fifth Circuit does in this opinion. It says that the meaning of automatically. And the other thing is, in the context of automatic weapons, you have to understand that the word automatically has a particular meaning, and that's a meaning about what happens with the trigger. In an automatic weapon, the trigger never resets. There's a particular mechanism within the trigger that prevents the trigger from resetting, and that's what allows it to empty the magazine. In a semi-automatic weapon, even one equipped with a bump stock, that trigger resets for every single bullet. One trigger reset, one bullet, and and in fact, they talk about the initial pull of the trigger. Even that is really misleading, because the first pull of the trigger when you have a bump stock is the same as the second quote unquote pull. It's a bump either way. You put your finger on the trigger ledge and then you push forward with the offhand, and the first touch of the trigger is a bump as well. And they say, well, it's automatic after that. Well, no, it's not. After that, you have to push away from yourself with your offhand on the trigger, on the barrel shroud. So it's a weird version of automatically. And then in terms of the single function of the trigger, that's what I was just getting into in terms of the trigger reset. The Fifth Circuit here says, well, you know, this is talking about from sort of a shooter perspective, not from the mechanics of the trigger. But I think in the context of automatic weapons and what makes an automatic weapon different from a semi-automatic weapon, it's all about the trigger mechanism. That's the distinction between the two kinds of guns. So to sort of elide that distinction or gloss over that distinction, I think is not a fair reading of the statute. But we'll have to see. Maybe the larger Fifth Circuit will come to a different conclusion if we're willing to take the case, or perhaps this case will We'll be back with more right after this.
Welcome back in our last installment of our Fifth Circuit Palooza this week. We have the state of Louisiana versus Becerra. And this opinion is very interesting, not because of what it actually says about the underlying law, but what it says about what judges should do. And this is something we talk about quite a bit, and there's good judging and there's bad judging. And here, this is Southwick Graves and Costa, and Southwick was in the minority in our case.
Cochran?
In Cochran, yes, and I was trying to contrast the two. But in other words, but he's in the majority here, and I think he gives an extremely good lesson on how judging should be done in these cases, and I want to talk about it a little bit because it's interesting. So this is another vaccine case. It's not one of ours, but in this case, the lower court had taken a look at the lower court after BST. I've talked about this before. The Fifth Circuit struck down and enjoined the OSHA mandate. That's the OSHA rule that said employers with over 100 employees have to get everyone vaccinated or fire them, and or mask or test and all this other stuff. But in any event, the Fifth Circuit had come out with BST. So the lower court took a look at BST and did what I think I would do if I looked at BST. And it stayed this other vaccine mandate. And the other vaccine mandate gets a little closer to the nub here. The enjoined mandate applies to the staff of many Medicare and Medicaid certified providers, such as hospitals, long-term care facilities, home health agencies, and hospices. So this was using the spending power rather than the commerce power or any other power. It's using the spending power to direct the behavior of Medicare and Medicaid institutions. So the court, the district court looked at it and they and issued a nationwide injunction for every state in the country did not have to impose these mandates because the federal government had said to do so.
And how many states did you say were involved in the lawsuit?
14 were involved in the lawsuit, but it applied, the injunction applied to everybody.
Okay.
So here's, so the government said, hey, you got to get rid of this injunction. And what the court said is we deny the motion insofar as the order applies to the 14 plaintiff states. So in those states, the injunction maintains. We grant a stay as to the order's application to any other jurisdiction. And then he says, briefly, we will explain. It's a short order, but I think it really talks about how judging should be done in a modest way. And he talks about the injunction standard, you know, whether or not they've made a strong showing to succeed on the merits, whether the applicant will be irreparably injured, whether issuance of stay will substantially injure the other parties interested, and where the public interest lies. And so Southwick looks at BST, where, again, he was in the dissent, but he says that's the law. And I think here's what he said. He's talked about how this is the spending clause, so it's a different power, and they're going to have to look at that. But he says the secretary, meaning the government, will have the most difficulty overcoming the part of the ruling in BST that applied to, quote, the major questions doctrine. We thus focus on that issue in assessing whether the secretary has made a strong showing of likely success. And he says the district court held that the secretary's decision to enter the vaccine regulatory space for the first time implicates what some courts and commentators have called the major questions doctrine. And the commentators you're listening to now have called it that. Though apparently not yet, he puts in parentheses, so designated in a majority opinion for the Supreme Court. It appears to us, anyway, so then he has a footnote, and able researchers, meaning his clerks, I take it, for this panel have discovered that this doctrinal label has been used
I don't think my judge ever called me an able researcher when I was clerking.
Maybe that says something about you, Mark.
Well, maybe it does. I'm not sure I've seen that designation in an opinion before, though. That's
I agree. I haven't either. There. I thought it was kind of nice. Exactly.
It is kind of nice.
That sort of thing. It has been used only twice at the Supreme Court in merits opinions on a case, once in a concurrence and the other in a dissent. And he then shows Thomas concurred in Department of Homeland Security versus Regents, and Gundy v. United States, Gorsuch dissented. So he says that this major questions doctrine is emerging, but the Supreme Court hasn't actually in a majority called it that. But I think he knows where the law is going, and I think he's right. It appears to us not so much a new doctrine, but a new label for courts' methods of analyzing federal agencies' novel assertions of authority. For example, the Supreme Court did not give deference to the Food and Drug Administration's 1996 decision that had an implicit authority under its governing statutes to regulate tobacco. And he quotes the famous case of FDA v. Brown and Williamson tobacco. So what he's saying is that the courts have ways of looking at something that's new and says that an agency can do a lot of things to a broad group of Americans. They're going to look at that with a jaundiced eye, and what you call the doctrine doesn't matter so much as what it is. And I think he's right about that. And I think we're going to call it the major questions doctrine, but I do think that it has not been, it hasn't fully emerged. So I thought this case was interesting for that analysis. And then he says, our court relied on this in BST. And then he quotes, well, a CDC case. I think everyone, all our listeners should know, Alabama Association of Realtors v. Department of HHS, where the CDC wasn't allowed to just shut off the state courts to evictions because they don't have that power. Because if the Congress wanted to give them that power, we'd know about it. It'd be in the statute, and it ain't. So no, out. It's a major question. You can't just aggrandize that much of the economy to yourself without any kind of heads up from Congress.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness. But and any talks about how the secretary, meaning the government, identifies meaningful distinctions between its rule for Medicare and Medicaid funded facilities and the broader OSHA rule. The statutory authority for the rule is different. Medicare and Medicaid were enacted under the spending clause rather than the commerce clause. And the targeted healthcare facilities, especially nursing homes, are where COVID-19 has posed the greatest risk. It's a close call whether these distinction or others of BST Holdings will ultimately convince the panel hearing this appeal. Nonetheless, the first stay factor requires more than a close call. We cannot say that the secretary has made a strong showing of likelihood of success on the merits. So what he's telling is, when all said and done, you might win, but it hasn't been showed to us that you're likely to win. So then he goes to the other, he says, look, so you don't get the stay broken, but we will pare it back. And he pares it back for federalism reasons and for reasons of judicial modesty. So though we deny the stay generally, we also consider whether the preliminary injunction should remain in effect beyond the 14 states that have brought this suit.
Principles, right, 36 states didn't bring the suit.
Right. Principles of judicial restraint control here. Other courts are considering these same issues, with several courts already inconsistently ruling. And he cites Florida v. Department of HHS, where the Fourth Circuit didn't enjoin a rule after a district court refused to. And then Missouri v. Biden.
The 4th or the 11th?
The 11th, you're correct. The 11th, okay. Excuse me. And then Missouri v. Biden, which has been affirmed by the 8th Circuit now, I know, but he didn't know it when he wrote this, enjoining rule in the 10 plaintiff states. So in addition, the many states that have not brought suit may well have accepted and even endorsed the vaccination rule. So the question posed is whether one district court should make a binding judgment for the entire country. At times, we've answered the question affirmatively, and he talks about the immigration, because if you can come in one port, you can come in all of them. But this isn't that kind of case. The district court gave little justification for issuing an injunction outside the 14 states that brought this suit. And so lacking is either the constitutional uniformity principle in the immigration case, or that case is concerned that patchwork rulings would undermine an injunction limited to certain jurisdictions. And he notes Justice Gorsuch doesn't like nationwide injunctions. And then he says this vaccine rule is an issue of great significance currently being litigated throughout the country. And Mark and I have to agree about that. Its ultimate resolution will benefit from, quote, the airing of competing views in our sister circuits. Though here, too, as with other issues before us, we are not in a position to make definitive pronouncements about the outcome of this appeal, we do predict that the secretary is likely to prevail in limiting the scope of the injunction. So he just goes ahead and does it. And I really like this opinion, because I do think that he's looking at the whole system of the federal judiciary and how it's supposed to work, and whether or not he thinks the mandate is a good thing or a legal thing or a bad thing. And remember, this is a judge who, and Costa, they were in the minority in BST. But they are faithfully applying BST, but also faithfully applying the idea that you don't solve all the cases in the district court all at once. So I think it's a very Solomonic decision. And I thought it was worth bringing up for that reason, rather than any vaccine mandate or other reason. He doesn't really talk about the mandate. He doesn't even make a decision on the law of whether it's going to go or not. He says, here are the arguments. They're colorable. They're not insubstantial, but I'm not deciding them. We're not deciding them here. Our issue is, do we maintain the status quo? And he says, for those states that are complaining, we maintain the status quo. That's what we should do. But we're not going to do it for everybody. If you want to, you know, the squeaky wheel will get oiled. You didn't squeak, you're not getting oiled. It's kind of where he's going here.
Well, I'm not sure if it's Solomonic or not, because they actually split the baby.
Yeah, I guess that's true, with less dire consequences, I hope.
Well, I mean, I think this is as you rightly point out, when you have judges who were in the dissent but recognize that they need to apply circuit law, that's a good thing. And then, you know, we've never been big fans of nationwide injunctions on this show or at NCLA. So, you know, I think there's something to be said for this approach.
I do, too. And I think noticing that, you know, there might be circumstances where you have to have it nationwide. Otherwise, the injunction itself doesn't function.
Yeah.
That's reasonable. I thought the whole thing's reasonable. And as for this, in the Ninth Circuit, the judges often don't feel that they're bound by the cases they lost. So this is also refreshing if you're used to reading those opinions. Anyway, a very good opinion by Cal. We were unhappy with the BSD, but this is good. We'll see you next time.
And Cargill and Cochran. We've been unhappy with them all.